Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Our topic today is entitled, It's a Water Catchment, Not a Watershed. And I'm delighted to be speaking with Cindy Hawes, wildlife biologist and president of the Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub. Welcome, Cindy. Can you tell more about yourself?
Oh, let's see about myself. So I've spent many years as a wildlife biologist, but so that is kind of where I'm coming from mostly. But I also have a lot of background in other natural resources jobs in terms of out in the forest and on the land and farming and in engineering and fire. You pretty much name it. And I did it before I became a wildlife biologist professionally for many years. And then after that, I began to teach. And now I'm semi-retired, but I'm much involved with Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub in teaching both youth, all through youth to adults of all ages. Our organization really wants to bring good information about natural processes and species into our area here in Douglas County, and help teachers teach high quality science education. And we focus in the field and the outdoors and connecting to nature. Let's see. And in addition to that, I teach at Umpqua Community College, teach conservation principles of fisheries and wildlife, wildlife biology.
So when you work with the community now, the Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub, who are the people you work with? How do you find the classes you work with or the people you work with or the schools? How do other people find you, for instance?
Well, that is always a challenge because of it's hard to market and connect these days with everything because everybody's so busy. Frankly, the best way we connect with people is through developing relationships in some form or another in some event or setting. So events are real valuable to get out there and communicate to people that we're here and what we're doing, connecting directly with teachers at schools. And in my teaching at Umpqua Community College, I connect with adult students. And one of the key elements of our structure and strategy is to recruit as many of those adult students who are interested in wildlife or fisheries or some form of outdoor natural resource education into the work we're doing. And one of the main things I like to focus on is project-based learning. And our focus for project-based learning is wetland restoration. Not that there aren't other restoration opportunities and needs. That's just one that we've been focusing on in recent years.
And I recently met Cindy. In fact, I met her about 5 months ago, and I've worked with her since in and out as I find opportunity to do so. And one thing Cindy always tells me, I say watershed, and every time Cindy corrects me and said, don't call it a watershed, call it a water catchment. So Cindy, can you tell me, what is a watershed? Is it just a river? What is a watershed?
Well, there are different sizes of water catchments. And let me just say something about why I say water catchment. And by the way, it's interesting that the United Kingdom, if you ask them, they would say water catchment. So where did the whole term watershed come from? Okay. And first of all, it came from geologists and engineers. Why? Why did they take that term? And it's because of humans and their fear of flooding and the damage flooding has done. And of course, that's because we put infrastructure in places that have these amazing and important natural processes. And that infrastructure is affected by natural processes. And we fail to understand in at least past time, and I think we're becoming better now, but need to still change our understanding of how those natural processes, including flooding, are so critical for all of our ecosystem in general and maintaining our ecosystem, including the benefits that provides to humans. And so this fear of flooding and the fact that humans tend to live right near water bodies, right, is our own making, so to speak. And my dear mentor, Chris Mazur, author of many books, is the one who told me, it's time to stop saying watershed, say water catchment, because language is powerful because it's directly tied to how we view the world. And it's really clear now because of climate change and because of all of these modifications we've made to our landscape around us in, especially in Oregon, you could go anywhere, but in Oregon, in our mountains and in our valleys, those modifications have significantly impacted our water abundance. And so it's really important for us now with climate change causing increased droughts and increased magnitude. So increased frequency of drought and increased magnitude of drought is actually caused not just, of course, human caused climate change, but also human infrastructure has increased the magnitude, increased the impact to our land and to us in terms of the amount of water that we have available to us. And we know that's continuing to decline. And so now I hope we can really see the importance of catching water. And that's what we're going to talk about today is how our landscape catches water and stores water.
So when you say watershed, I know as children, when I talk to that, they think it's the river. The watershed is the river. And your point is not quite. Your point is it's the whole area and it's the point of catching the water, maybe even before it gets to the river.
Thank you. I forgot to answer that question. But yes, so what a water catchment slash watershed is defined as all the way to the top of the ridge, so the highest elevation in an area. And,
so the
and
mountain.
In our case, the tops of the mountains, right, the ridgelines, and all the way down to the ocean. That's a watershed. Now, those watersheds, say, for example, the Umpqua Basin, which is much more appropriate because that says catch water basin, right? The Umpqua Basin, and we have a unique situation here in the Umpqua in that our county boundaries are literally the boundaries of our water catchment. So all the way up to the top of the ridgelines, all those headwater where all the springs are begin and then turn into streams that then turn into the river and then go to the ocean. That is a watershed. And there are different actual classifications because within that where you have a sub watershed, which could be what we call a fifth field watershed. And then within that is a sixth field watershed, which is even smaller. You know, it's like this, there's little stream systems that would be considered a unit within it. And then a bigger unit within that is a fifth field watershed, like for some people who may be familiar with the Little River drainage or the Little River. Right. And here again, the Little River catchment. The Little River is, if you look at that, that's called a fifth field watershed. So all of the Little River and the creeks flowing into it would be called a fifth field watershed, but it flows into the North Umpqua, right? And so that's a bigger, even bigger one. And then the North Umpqua joins the South Umpqua, which is a whole separate into the main stem. And then there are other ones down below there that move into the main stem. So hope that helps.
So when I talk to people about Umpqua watersheds, very often they ask me, well, where does the water in the Umpqua watershed come from? Or I will ask them and they'll say, well, it comes from the river. But the water in the watershed does not come from the river. Right? Where does the water come from? That sounds like where it ends up, perhaps.
Yes. And that's such a perfect example of what we need to expand in terms of people's view of what we have and what it all means. Because yes, where does the water come from? You know, their drinking water might come from a river, but where does that water come from that they drink or that they use for their garden or whatever? And that is what is really important to understand here, because our water catchment is our mountains. And if you were to look on Google Earth, you would see that very clearly, that most, if you looked, you would see that there's the Western Cascade Range and then on the east side, and there's the Coast Range on the west side of, you know, Coast Range of mountains. And that those mountains, in between those mountains are these little valleys, including the Quad Valley. And so there's really not a underground aquifer of a lot of water in our world. So where does our water come from? It's the mountains that is our water catchment and our water storage. I call them upside down wells, because that gives me and others, I hope, a better visual of what our mountains do and how important they are and what condition they're in for catching our water. And it's not just the actual, quote, topography of the mountain, but it also includes what kind of trees are on, what kind of forest, what is the composition of the forest, what is critically the structure of the forest, including age class. We know now that ages of the trees matters in terms of water catchment and water storage. We know the ground itself, the soil that has to be maintained by the forest through trees dying and falling over and becoming soil, holds our water. And then below that, there's a fractured bedrock, which also catches and holds the water. And all of that is really critical. And it is the way it works is that we have a very droughty sort of summer naturally in the West. Mm-hmm. We don't get much rain in the summer unless your hay field is not harvested yet. But right. We don't get much rain in the winter. We get our rain or summer. We get our rain in the winter, and that's what catches the water and holds the water. And so even in the summer, we depend on the winter rains and the winter snow in the mountains. And the mountains have to be of a structure to hold that over time for us.
So is it the mountain and the rock and the geology that's catching the water? Or is it what's on top of the mountain? Is it the vegetation? Is it the grass? Is it the trees? Is it the mountain stopping the cloud from going across? Or is it which part of the mountain is catching the water?
Good question. Okay. So, you know, you almost have to go from the, you have to look at it from, you know, even in different layers, right? We have a unique situation where we have these Douglas fir trees in particular, and we have dominated Douglas fir forests, and Douglas fir grow to be very tall naturally. We have altered that in our management practices, and that's really important to understand, but Douglas firs can grow to be tall to capture the water in the atmosphere, even when it's not raining. They can capture atmospheric water and they can collect that and they can bring it into the ground and they can actually use it. And then they can, what we call transpire it, evapotranspiration. And when they do that, they can recapture it. So fog, right? So it's not just rain and snow, but it's the trees and the fog that help us capture and store water. And the way that trees do it, in terms of, think about surface area volume ratios, okay? You have lots of needles, you have lots of structure out there that you can capture this on, and then it can slowly move into and down into the ground, and the ground can then hold it. And then, of course, then the ground has to have, getting down from the canopy level, obviously the more canopies you have, which means more mature and old forest, the more canopy layers you have, and underground lower level layers, the higher the amount of capturing and holding water. But also those trees, they die, they fall over, they break down, and they make soil. So if you take all those trees and you cut them and you put them on a log truck and you take them away, you're literally taking away the future soil. You're taking away that water holding capacity, because not only the dead logs themselves, the dead trees themselves, they will hold water over 500, 600 years under the forest, even through fire regime. Okay. The fire regimes just create that process. And they also create biochar, which fertilizes the land, but water and the logs themselves over time will hold water. And the plants in the understory know that, and they grow their roots into them, including fungi that grow their mycelium into them. And the fungi themselves transfer water in the soil network. And so you've got a number of processes of water storage in there, but you have to have the soil layers maintained over time. Right. And so that soil is not real deep, but it's like your skin is not real deep, but it's critically important for its water storage water catchment and storage function. And then the fractured bedrock stores water, but there are things that we've done that even impact the fractured bedrock storage. So you've got all of that kind of those processes happening that store the water. And since, of course, we're talking about mountains, you know that that's the gravity works, right? So over time, that water slowly moves down the mountain, only slowly, however, if you have all these structures in place. If you remove all this stuff, all the biomass, all the structures, and then you put roads in the landscape, then all of those things are, quote, drainage features. And they drain the water.
All right. So if you're just joining us, this is Living Downstream on 99.7 KQUA. I'm your host, Julie Lowe. And we're speaking with Cindy Hawes of the Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub and a watershed educator. We're talking about it's a water catchment, not a watershed. So Cindy, you told me, you keep mentioning this Douglas fir, and you say it can reach way up high. How tall are we talking? What is this Douglas fir, and how tall are they? And is it better than a birch or not a redwood, ponderosa pine? Or tell me about the Douglas fir a little bit.
Yes, the Douglas fir is one of the tallest trees in the world. It's one of three. They kind of compete depending on who's tallest at the time. You've got your redwoods, and there are actually eucalyptus in Australia that get pretty tall as well. Funny enough, all three of these species have the same kind of function I'm talking about. They have symbiotic relationships with fungi, and we wouldn't have those tall trees if it wasn't for those fungi because of what they bring to the trees. And so knowing that all the way over in Australia, the reason that eucalyptus trees can get so tall is similar to the reason that Douglas fir can get so tall, because Douglas fir doesn't have a rooting system that in and of itself can facilitate that, getting all the water and the nutrients that they need. But the fungi can get much further into the soil, depth and spread. You know, some of the biggest things in the world, the organism in the world is a fungi. And so they can get in between teeny tiny little soil particles and get water that the tree roots can't get. And so yes, the Douglas fir is one of the three tallest trees in the world, that they can get 300 feet tall. Not nowadays, there's not many of those left because of timber harvest.
And how long would it take a tree, a Douglas fir in particular, to get that tall?
Oh, probably I'm not the expert on this, but I would estimate between 400 and 600 years.
Wow. So how many years minimally does that Douglas fir need to be productive for us in a selfish kind of way? How many years does it need to get tall enough to be able to reach up there and grab that water for us?
Good question. Because the reality is that there have been studies by Dr. Julia Jones at Oregon State University and Dr. Timothy Perry on this very topic. And they've taken years of data from experimental forests, and I mean like 60 years of data in terms of post-harvest response and stream flows. They monitored the stream flows in these areas after different kinds of experimental timber harvest. And with that information, it really provides an interesting picture. First of all, what they have found is it takes up to about 70 years before a Douglas fir can function to conserve its water and start this process and conduct this process that we're talking about. So what that means is that the younger Douglas fir trees can't do that. And not only that, the younger Douglas fir trees actually are they're leaky. They're inefficient at conserving water. They evapotranspire water at much higher rates. And so they suck the water out of the ground at much higher rates, dry the ground up. And it's kind of, if you imagine that, having a landscape as we have now today, with much more of the acres in the forests, on the mountains, in trees that are younger than 70 years, means that we have a lot of water getting sucked up, put in the atmosphere, and not recycled back to the ground, because these younger trees can't do that as effectively.
So what's the problem? Why don't we just cut these trees down we'll give them to 75 years. We'll let them get to 70. We'll give them 5 years to work for us, and then we'll cut them down. What's the problem?
Well, that's certainly not enough time to function, right?
Right.
And so it's not going to provide the ecological functions that you're looking for. You're basically kind of nipping everything in the bud, literally.
And And in fact, how I don't know much about the timber industry. I don't know about harvesting trees, but how often when they do have harvesting, how often do they harvest? If they replant and then harvest again, how often are trees typically harvested?
Well, that has generally been, of course, it depends on if it's public land or private land. And you've got about 50-50 here in our landscape of that. And so the private land have a 40-year, and I would say they sometimes go 40 to 60, okay, year rotation. They call it a rotation where they go out and clear cut every 40 to 60 years. It kind of depends on the growth of the trees. And on public lands, that varies. But it could be 80 years, it could be 70 years. I've seen public lands actually up the road from me, the BLM, clear cut some forest at 65 years, I believe it was. And interestingly enough, that caused some landslides, which is another thing that happens. You can get these kinds of landslides from removing the vegetation. And what's interesting about that soil condition to me is that those types of soils actually are clay soils that hold the water longer. But when you get a landslide and you lose all that pocket of soil, you're literally reducing the storage capacity as well. So, yeah, so it's 40 to 60 or so on in generally with private land, and it ranges with public land. It could be 60, 80 or more, depending on the kind of designation that public land has on a particular area.
So when you're saying 40 to 60, that tree is cut down before it can do any catchment work, really, because it's under the age of, let's say, 70. So it's almost a water hog at that point, rather than a water catchment or water store. So we're doing nothing. We're doing nothing. And we're removing those trees. And then your landslide, I'm now picturing in my mind a landslide. You know, we think a lot of mud and water running down, but what we're literally losing is water, and we're literally losing mud. And from what you're telling me, that mud and soil and grasses is what saves our water, which catches our water.
Yeah, it stores it, you know, and it slows it down. It's kind of like in the stream, if you think of stream structures and all that we've talked about before, it slows the movement of water down over time. It holds on to that water, and those big pockets of clay, which are good, you know, everything slowly moves, gravity works, but we increase the frequency and magnitude of that. And so we lose that water. Just like you said, you lose, you know, it causes all that to unravel, and then you don't have that storage capacity.
And when I'm picturing again in my mind a landslide, that soil, that land, that grass, that mud, that clay is all going down the hill. I've never seen a truck go back up a hill carrying dirt. Do you know what I mean? So there's no way to replace a landslide. That soil, that water catchment soil, is gone forever. I don't see trucks going up the other way carrying soil. So where does soil come from? Am I correct in understanding it comes from the breakdown of trees and other vegetation through the work of snails and decomposers?
Exactly. You know, if you don't have the trees there, you're not going to be getting much biomass into that soil. Combine that with you lose the structure of like rocks and other things within the soil that move down with those landslides as well and don't hold everything in place anymore. And so, yeah, and there's different kinds of landslides. The kind I'm talking about right now is what we would call a shallow landslide. Uh-huh. Those deep-rooted ones that are similar in terms of their, you know, some of the things that cause them to move. But there's no doubt that tree removal can cause these kinds of, and roading, it's how you know, the roads out there also do this, they can actually concentrate because of the road itself. It cuts into the water table, and it causes water to concentrate in some of these spots. And then that causes that to become too heavy after you cut the trees out, and then everything slides down.
So it seems to me, roads, if I can picture now a road going up a mountain, that looks like basically a river we cut into the mountain that's just letting the water go down and not be caught, because roads, of course, have no branches and trees and leaves and grass on them. So those roads are just a pathway for water to get out of the mountain.
Exactly. And what people don't realize is that every time in a mountain, because it's got slope, right?
Right.
When you build a road in the mountains, unless it's on top of a ridge the entire time, which that rarely is the case, all of those roads that we build cut down into the water table, into what the storage tank, and they cut, and then they push the soil over to the other side to fill it in order to establish that roadbed. And so what you're basically doing, and every time you do that, is you're like cutting all the underground water pipes, if you want to call it. It's not really pipes, but the underground water. And that causes the water to come out in all of those places much sooner than it would had it been just like it should be, slowly moving down through that soil over time and through the fragmented rock over time. This instead cuts it open. It's like a bleeding wound, right? And cuts it open, where, and all those miles of road then extend the drainage and cause a much greater drainage, a much faster drainage of the water, and you lose your water catchment function again.
Because a road is not like a deer path where the deer walk on top of the soil on a path. A road is actually cut into our topsoil and our catchment soil layers. And that is removed. So our catchment is just removed right there.
Exactly. That's a good description of, or, you know, kind of a comparison. Yeah.
Right. The road is cut into it. It's not the road. People don't drive on top of the soil. When a road is actually made, it's cut into it. That's interesting. All right. Well, then based on that, I would think even a creek would take our water away. We wouldn't want creeks coming out of the mountain because isn't that taking our water away? So talk to me about creeks. Clearly we want our creeks, and clearly our fish and our amphibians want the creeks. How do I recognize a healthy creek? What's a healthy looking creek that is actually working with the trees and working with the soil and not damaging the whole system? Are there features in the creek I should look for?
Absolutely. And that's why you got to connect the streams and the creeks with the upside down wells, right? Mm-hmm. And so creeks form through topographical change, whereby water will naturally surface. We call those springs. Okay. Headwaters are springs, right? And so there's different kinds of springs, obviously, but it's oftentimes, you know, because you can get your fractured rock springs, but all of them are like that. So when you get these springs, they pop out, and you get enough of those, they start, you know, creating creeks. And creeks are, like you said, they're very beneficial for many things. And generally speaking, they're not like all of, you know, you haven't added all those miles of road on top of the springs. So what are those, what would it look like? Of course, from adding all those miles of road on top of the springs, as well as timber harvest, you have springs and creeks that don't look like they used to look, right? They don't have what they used to have that held water in springs and creeks and streams and stored water there, including all the way down to the valley bottom and how the valley bottom functions. So what are you missing? You're missing structure. You're missing the trees, the big trees and the beaver. Those two things, trees and beaver, have been a major part of making streams function to store water and to slow the water down and create all these different kinds of habitat conditions for lots of species. So those streams and creeks would have lots of big trees falling into them. Why are they big? Well, they're big because that's the lower part of a mountain where there's that's where all the nutrients are gonna concentrate by the stream. Mm-hmm. And so the tree, and they're going to have more water there, obviously. So the trees, if you're going to get big 300-foot trees, you're more likely to get them there than you would someplace else. And then those big, huge trees fall into the stream. And what do? Well, they hold back the gravel and they hold back the water, and they push the water to the side, not just downstream. You know, they don't just hold it back from going downstream, but they push it out into the side. And so, you know, the gravel obviously is really important for water, because the gravel provides it reduce when you push the water down through gravel, you reduce the flow, and you know, because you're holding the water longer, you increase the oxygen in the water, which is real important. You filter the water. What else? You change the, did I say temp? No, I haven't talked temperature. You reduce it, you cool the water. And so there's lots of conditions in those streams that are, if everything is, all the composition structure is in place, you get the functioning of all of that. But if you don't have those things in place, and you have these high flows that are happening because of the roads and the lack of structure, then you, what happens is that it literally is like a fire hose. You know, you ream the stream, and then you start getting very simplified structure, and the water goes much faster downstream, and you lose it in the winter. Like there's 50-60% of the water you lose in the winter that we didn't lose prior to all of our alterations. And when you get down to the valley bottom, especially where you have more soil just naturally because of gravity, and you've lost all of the structure up above, you really have trouble with erosion because of the high stream flows that you get from that, and the lack of structure, and the lack of gravel being held back in those places as well. And so that's what has caused a lot of loss of salmon spawning habitat. And not just, and then we always talk about spawning habitat for salmon, but we forget that those little baby coho salmon, for example, and cutthroat trout and others have to live in those streams in the winter. When we created all of those, we shed all of that water now because of all of those roads and the timber harvest. You get these really high flows with no place for the fish to rest. They don't have the structures and the slow water and the pools to rest. And so they die. They literally die from exhaustion.
And I heard you say something about temperature as well. Does that matter to fish? Does temperature matter?
Absolutely. Now, as opposed to the past, our temperatures in our waters are lethal to fish. Most of the year, 70 degrees or higher will kill fish. And it doesn't just kill fish. In my own direct observation, it kills crayfish too. And so, and probably many other things die just from having 70 degree water, 70 degree plus water in our streams.
Well, we've talked about the Douglas fir. We've talked about the fungi. What about animals besides the fish? How about the beaver? When we were small, we thought the beaver was a big rat and it was dangerous and it was mean and it would hurt us. And plus it flooded our meadows and then the cows got stuck. So everybody wanted to get rid of the beavers. We also every summer cleaned out our creek, cleaned out all the debris and all the trees and the brushes. And we made that creek run fast. We thought that meant a healthier creek if it was running fast. We cleared out the beaver. We cleared out the dams. We cleared out the creek. From what I'm hearing from you, that was exactly the wrong thing to do. Tell me about the beaver. Do we need them anymore?
Absolutely. And we don't have enough of them. You know, one of the things I like to teach in my classes is about, in terms of wildlife, and they're, you know, they conduct so many functions for us that we don't acknowledge and realize. And, I can just think of how squirrels and the Clark's Nutcracker are forest tree planters. We think we have to go out and plant the trees every time we have a forest fire. No, there are organisms out there that do that. So go to the beaver. The beaver is an absolute amazing species that does so many things by influences and changes the environment. So that again is a composition. The beaver is a species composition that has these functions that are what we call keystone. I think there's got to be even a better word for this, because they create so much function in what they do, so many different functions by what they do in terms of their damming and occupancy. So you have to have, in order to have the function, you can't just have one beaver here and one beaver there. You have to have an abundance of beaver to facilitate a function. So we've lost that abundance. History of removal And we continue to remove beaver because we think they're going to because they clog our culverts, et cetera. The beaver actually put in these dams that slow the water down, really key, so that the water can absorb in the adjacent terrestrial habitat out to, like, it could be 1,200 feet or more in some places. They can actually create side channels that move water even further into the terrestrial land that we want to maintain as productive land, right? So they do that. They slow the water down and push the water into the adjacent areas to make that water really work for us, us as humans and other life. And they, from that structure that they create pools. Those pools, which we're now missing, most of our streams have glide dominated now and bedrock dominated. So those pools are missing. So you have these different kinds of habitat naturally in a stream, and that includes pools and glides and riffles. And the pools are really key for fish to maintain, you know, it reduces the water temperature. The pools are cooler. It's a refuge habitat for fish when in the warm summer. It's also a resting habitat for them in winter flows. And so the young salmon, the little tiny little baby salmon, really need those pools, as do the adult salmon, but the young salmon especially for rearing. And the pools also collect food that then feeds the system. And those pools, there's the structure of the dam adjacent to the pool forces the water down into the underground zone we call the hyporheic zone. And that area is amazing in that it filters the water. It adds oxygen to the water. And when I say filter the water, there's documentation of taking nitrogen out of the water, taking phosphorus out of the water. And now we learned that there's data that shows that it takes heavy metals and other types of pollutants out of the water, right? Thanks to the beaver. And so all of that is really important from that standpoint. And then they hold the gravel, just like the big logs that fall into the stream. And the beaver need those big logs to build their dams on, or they get blown out more frequently.
Right.
And that's really key to understand in our world, mm-hmm. where there's a lot of gradient in our streams. But the gravel buildup is really important because the gravel is what does a lot of that job I just mentioned, you know, cleaning the water, and because it creates habitat for all these other organisms. So beaver create a lot of habitat for other organisms, including the aquatic organisms that clean out nitrogen and other things from the water, stores carbon, all those things. It reduces temperature, increases oxygen in the water. I think I hit on everything. I might have missed something, but that's what beaver do.
Yeah, and I've heard people say, well, the beaver take the water. They take the water because they make a dam and there's no more water coming down. They don't take the water, right? It's not as if they took the water elsewhere. What happened to the water? Okay, it's not flowing anymore, but it is still flowing, isn't it? Like the water is going somewhere. So if it's not coming over the dam, first of all, when a beaver builds a dam, is it solid or is there still water coming through?
Oh, it's just like a filter. It's not solid. The water's
so
coming
not solid.
Through. No. And you know, it might reduce the flow of water but it doesn't take the water away. The water's still there. It might go into the what we call the adjacent stream habitat, the riparian habitat, right? Or further.
Right.
In fact, there are a lot of people in our world, in this Umpqua world, that they have wells, and their wells, they might start noticing, not all, but a lot of them are really tapping into the underground water near a stream, and they may not realize that there's an old channel they might be tapping into. Maybe there's some springs they're tapping into, but a lot of it is stuff that originally the beaver are really good at pushing out away from the actual stream. Doesn't mean the water's lost. It eventually still goes down. It may pop up someplace else, but it's not lost. It's still there. And I think they've done measurements to show that you really don't lose the water. And also there's been this issue or concern that beaver dams, just like log jams, prevent salmon from, adult salmon from moving upstream spawn. And that's been proven false. I just heard a really, anyway, that's been proven false.
Well, they've coexisted for years. Yeah.
Yep. In fact, they've been doing fine. Yeah. It's
right.
a cooperative, mutual, beneficial relationship.
Right. All right. I do have friends in the area who have been complaining lately. They've lived here for years, 50 years, and lately their wells have been going dry. And I thought wells didn't go dry. I thought, well, underground water was always there. That's why we call it springs, right? I always thought springs ran eternal. Is this not true?
No. Everything, of course, that we've been talking about up to this point in time is why their wells are going dry.
Right.
We have caused the water to be concentrated and drained in the winter. So they're not getting it, you know, of course, in the wintertime is not when they're getting dry wells, it's probably in the summer.
Right.
But that, you know, but it used that, that's the main point, is that the water leaves hugely in the winter, like it never did before, on a very frequent basis. And so they're not, it's that water storage function that we've lost on the landscape that they're suffering from. They just haven't connected the dots, which is hard to do. It's a lot of ecological processes that many people just don't know about, but that's exactly what is going on. My well, which is situated just like I described earlier, has not dried up yet, but it's definitely gotten lower and lower and lower over the years I've been here, which is 35. And my family has had that similar experience, that after logging and roading, their creeks dried up. And then funny, you know, just it took about until I would say about, I want to say 7 or 8 years ago, maybe a little 10 years ago, it almost started like seeming like it was going to recover, right? Because it was that long since logging and stuff, but relatively recover, not come to where go back to where it was. They literally could. They used to raise a garden, and they couldn't raise a garden anymore. And that's scary for people that live in this country, because we want to be self-sufficient, and the idea that you don't have enough water to raise a garden unless you pay an arm and a leg to purchase that water. That's where we're headed.
Your point is we're not catching the water.
We're not catching the water anymore. We're not focused on water storage. And a dam, like building dams, that's something that people think, oh, well, we'll just build a dam on the stream and then we'll store the water that way. Well, that causes all kinds of other major issues, including major loss of water quality in terms of temperature problems, toxic algae problems, loss of species, loss of salmon, just goes on and on from that standpoint. That's another engineered structure that does not function anywhere near as good as beaver and the mountains, if they're functioning intact and functioning.
That it all evolved to work together.
Yep. And that's what we benefited from to start with, you know, is there all of their work is what created the abundance that we enjoyed.
Right. Talk to me more about how the water table influences the quality of our water.
The water table? Is that what you said?
Yeah. Because that's where all the water is stored, right? Is the water table. I guess, does that affect the quality of our water?
How it's stored definitely does.
How it's stored. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. How it's stored. You know, if you think again about the way that the mountains are a big filter, right? And the fact, okay, and water quality includes water abundance, water, so the amount of water, but also from the standpoint of whether the water has bad algae in it that is a problem, or temperature issues, or high nitrogen or high phosphorus, those kinds of things, that's water quality. And all of those things have been affected by the loss of all of these ecological processes that we're talking about, and the structures, and therefore the composition. So composition, structure, function, that we have altered so much.
Tell me, is there anything people can do to make a difference? And by people, I mean individuals. Like, is there something I can do or my class, if I have a class I'm teaching, or a group of people? Or is it something that companies have to do or the government has to do? Is there something people can do individually
to
help
well,
this problem?
I really think people can do a lot individually because much of the, for first of all, much of our water comes from our public lands. And our public lands actually have laws that say that they're supposed to protect all of the things that we just talked about. Mm-hmm. And especially in terms of water, water output, water abundance. And as individuals and in joining organizations, if you don't want to individually do it, right, you join organizations and you become a part of that and you support that in having them communicate and push and, if necessary, legally pursue through courts the protection of those resources for us. So that's a biggie, and you know, and you can do that. Everybody can participate in that, and so that would be my first thing. Is that, you know, thought is that even if you individually feel like you can't comment on right now, there's a new process, forest management planning process going on. That forest management plan is how things get implemented on in the mountains, on public lands. And there is an aquatic conservation strategy associated with the U.S. Forest Service's efforts. Used to be the Bureau of Land Management effort as well, but they've managed to squeak out of that, though frankly, I think they need to be pushed back in. And the aquatic conservation strategy actually pretty significantly directs you as to what to do, including reducing road densities. You can, and this is really good because one of the students recently asked, well, what can be done? And I had mentioned to them that roads can be, they can be what we call decommissioned. Uh-huh. And the hydrologic function, I can't say nothing can be totally restored, but the hydrologic function can be substantially reconnected and, right, and improved. And so that's a biggie. Supporting beaver. And how do you support beaver? Well, we currently, the situation is that wetlands need to be protected more. People are maybe not aware of the impact to wetlands. And secondly, a biggie is that beaver are still allowed to be trapped and hunted. And you're not, you know, that's the problem. And you don't have an abundant enough population out there to do the function that they do. So that needs to be addressed, that we stop trapping and lethally removing beaver in one way or another. We use some of the now well-established, well-known technology to address some of the flooding concerns that beaver may cause or some of the road damage concerns. We know how to do that now. We know how to wrap trees so that if you have special trees on private land, you don't want the beaver to eat. Well, we can do that. It's not right, hard, and there are people out there that'll help with that. So getting connected with the local beaver advocacy group through South Umpqua Rural Community Partnership, and that sort of pushing Oregon Department, writing letters to Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, telling them that you really think the beaver management policies need improvement. And mm-hmm. that includes senators and representatives, because there, you know, there are some actions now in play on trying to improve those, to reduce those lethal beaver removals, but that needs much more public support.
Okay.
So those are a couple of things. And of course, timber harvest, again, when these, a new forest plan for the Umpqua National Forest is being written, as in the whole region, they're doing forest planning. People can participate in what they think needs to be done out there and what the priorities should be. Rather than logging, you should be doing restoration, because we need to prepare for climate change. Just right, like on the coast, where they're getting all their issues of flooding and all of that, here in the mountains, we need to prepare for climate change as well. And that doesn't mean accepting the fact that everything's going to turn into a pine forest. We need to let the forest decide what the forest is going to be. And we can do that by restoring the conditions that the forest needs and letting things, natural processes there happen, getting more back to more of the range of old, mature and young forest that used to be here.
And as a new landowner and myself here, I have several acres and I'm on top of a mountain, top of a hill. And I have neighbors encouraging me to cut down. They say you need to timber and you need to clear out all the undergrowth and all the dead trees and the snags and whatnot. They say it's a fire hazard, that I need to clear up my property. What would you say to them?
Well, it is kind of it's a conundrum when you're within an area that has a lot of housing, right?
Right.
Those are the areas that you need to protect your structures. And how do you do that? And you can do that without what they're talking about. You can do that in a way that does protect the structures, but doesn't necessarily eliminate the undergrowth and the dead wood and the forest that you're talking about. But that's unfortunately not communicated by a lot of agencies and Extension Service. They have a different perspective on that because they're still operating on a very old paradigm. And so fire suppression and has been a challenge, and a fire prevention. I hope that eventually we get to the point where we recognize that we need to take our houses, for example, and make them out of things that are more resistant to fire. And there are plenty of materials out there now for that purpose. And then immediately around your house, you can clear. But okay. When you have a forest, you know, that's you don't, you know, the idea that you're basically throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It might look good to human mind if it's all cleaned and cleared underneath there, right. But it's just like, in my mind, vacuuming your house. You know, you're vacuuming your house and you're cleaning your house, but that goes the opposite direction of all these processes and functions that we all depend on. For a abundant and lush, I want to say, you know, those things that gave us the gifts of even humans having good resources are the things that we're afraid of, if you will. Yeah.
Right.
And in those public lands further away, we need to let the fires happen. Now I say that, and I know we have, you know, 80 something percent of our fires out there are human caused. And that's that issue, right? That's human caused fires. That's an issue. And on top of that, we have climate change. But you don't deal with that by thinking that you can go out and cut all the understory of a forest and thin it out and make it better. Because in fact, what you're doing when you do that is you're drying it out and you're making it worse because you're changing the microclimate.
You had mentioned, we've mentioned several times that you're with the Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub. You're the president. Do you have any tools or things we could use in the classroom or in community centers or with organizations that we could teach people these concepts?
Absolutely. The two lovely tools that we just recently got, thanks to the Gray Family Foundation, is a stream table model that's very portable, that actually has material in it that is designed to replicate water movement in a stream and how the gravel and the cobble and all of that moves in different conditions. So you can look at conditions where you have all your downwood and beaver dams and see how it functions versus when you don't have all of that, how it turns into from a nice sinuous, slow, you know, relatively slow moving stream most of the time with pool, all these different diversity of pools and glides and riffles, that habitats that support all the organisms in there, including salmon, to the loss of that structure. You can show that by removing the structure and see how it then turns into this straight channel that looks like a, trying to think of a best word for these channels, kind of like a gunite canal, you know,
right,
not
right.
Sterilizes the whole system in so many different ways. And that we don't benefit from either. It reduces our water quality increases temperature, causes toxic algae, and go on and on about how those kinds of conditions do that. And so we can demonstrate that with the stream table we have. And we love to go out and demonstrate that. And then the other model we have, because it's hard to see and visualize this stuff, is a groundwater model that really shows you how much we as humans can influence the water table and mm-hmm. increase the water table, decrease the water table. And there's where wells can go dry, right? By right. pulling too much water, you can see, say, for example, there's big issues in Eastern Oregon and other places where these mega dairies come in Texas. I remember, I think, hearing this in the Southwest, where these big mega dairies come in and are commercial, big commercial livestock operations, and they dig deep wells, and all of a sudden, all these people that live around them no longer have water, right? And so right. they're pulling so much water out that, and so people don't realize how one well can affect another well, and how whatever you put on the ground, be it a chemical like a herbicide or pesticide, can affect the whole water table, and how it's all connected, and how you can see it move in our groundwater model. You can see it move through that groundwater and see that contaminant gets into the lake, it gets into the wells, it gets into the river, and everybody suffers.
Fantastic. So it sounds like you have two models. You have one that will let them see a water catchment system working effectively, or at the same time, you can switch it up and show them a water catchment system not working at all. And then you have this water table model that can show them if your neighbor three farms down drops some chemical, you know, changes their oil or whatnot, drops chemicals in their backyard, how it might appear up in your well a few days later.
Yep. Or I would say not a few days later, but it doesn't go away.
Okay.
It's there. And it depends on the rate of movement, lots of factors, but you can look at that in this model. And not just say, you know, of course, they could put it on their land, right, if they're applying herbicides or pesticides. But then there are things like underground storage tanks, such as gas stations. People mm-hmm. forget, and there are a lot of old gas stations out there, and those have fossil, you know, they have gasoline and oil in them, and that stuff contaminates hugely. And so you have that, and you have septic systems, and then you know, then there's the issue that we're now having with chemicals like PFAS, which is the forever chemicals mm-hmm. that are getting into our water table. And that is causing, and that chemical has been determined to cause all kinds of different kinds of cancers, can potentially cause sterilization, liver function problems. It just goes on and on. And those that don't require, it's kind of like the whole issue with DDT many years ago. And it's used in all these different kinds of plastics, and everybody throws their plastics out, and you see plastics on the ditch banks, you see plastics in the landfills that still get into the water table because it's all connected. And that's what's nice about this groundwater model. It shows how everything is all connected. You can't separate it. You know, you can put liners in for a while, and liners will do some good to separate these toxic things from other things, but it doesn't completely stop these things. And another one, think of this, all of our septic systems and then all of our city water treatment plants, they can't take out our prescription drugs.
Right.
And a lot of those prescription drugs are now affecting the organisms in the water. And that's our drinking water too. So again, this is another thing to talk about with the groundwater model. You can say, okay, you know, what are all of the thyroid prescriptions and this prescriptions and that prescriptions? Because that stuff we take, it doesn't all stay in us. Mm-hmm. It goes out our waste products, and our waste products are connected to the groundwater.
All right, Cindy, this has been fantastic. I appreciate your time so much. This has been very informative. I love this. Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
And this has been an episode of Living Downstream. I'm your host, Julie Lowe. I've been speaking with Cindy Hawes of the Umpqua Natural Leadership Science Hub. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any interview in our series, you can find past episodes at umpquawatersheds.org. And thank you for listening.